Welcome back to Fear or Favour. Another really packed week we've got. Let's take people through some of the major cases that have really been going on this week. And of course, we're going to give our perspective as we always do. Not scared to give our opinion, are we, Nazir?
No, that's why we call our podcast Without Fear or Favour. We don't really care what anybody else thinks.
So let's start with this pressure that's growing on the Conservative Party to name an MP. Let's just give a small amount of background. So an MP in his 50s has been arrested over allegations relating to offences that occurred between 2002 and 2009 in London. And they include allegation of rape, indecent assault, sexual assault, and abuse of position of trust, and misconduct in public office. So the pressure is mounting because the Conservative Party and the party whips have told the MP to stay away from the House of Commons, but no formal sanctions are in place. And basically what that means is that the individual can still continue to meet constituents and to go to events outside of the House of Commons. This is a really difficult one. Of course, what we know is the police position is that until someone is charged, they will not name an individual unless there are exceptional circumstances for that naming to take place. This is a difficult one, though, isn't it? Because this is a person who's holding a public office.
Yeah, I think it's that thing about exceptional circumstances. I think we all accept now that you're innocent. Well, you are innocent until proven guilty. Some of these inquiries, investigations take months, if not years. It would be wrong for that person to be under the microscope without giving the opportunity to try and clear their name in a trial. And so I think people accept now that you should have anonymity until the point of charge. My view, and I suspect the view of many others, is that one, this individual is in a role of a public facing role that involves them meeting others. There clearly needs to be a risk assessment. These are allegations, of course. Nothing's been proved, but if they are meeting with other potential vulnerable people, then that causes something to be concerned about. My personal view again is, and we covered this with Savile previously, if there's more than one alleged victim, I think that should be one reason why you should name somebody. Not that we're saying this individual is anything like Jimmy Savile, but the reality is, and we know this from our own experience, and again, I'm not talking about this particular individual, sexual predators do have more than one victim. That's the nature of their activity. And so it would be right, I imagine, if there was more than one alleged victim for this person to be named as a matter of, as right, really, without any question being asked of it. But you add in the public-facing role, the fact that this individual is meeting with others in their work environment, that should be another reason why I personally believe you should name this man.
So there's two issues floating around here, isn't there? There's the naming and there's also the stopping of the individual being involved in any activities that are public facing at this present moment in time. You could argue that the latter one will result in the first one because they'll end up being named. Yeah. But I think they have to be taken individually. So the first point is that should this individual who has a very high profile, they are a public figure, should they be allowed to continue doing their role away from the House of Commons? So, for example, a police officer, a police officer has that position. They are stopped, allegations like this, they would be stopped from having any public role in any way at all. They most probably should be suspended.
Yep.
Why would that not be the same for an MP? I mean, we've got to have some clarity here. We've got to have some consistency, haven't we?
Well, that's your point, isn't it? Why treat MPs differently to any other professional? A doctor as well would be
absolutely
would not necessarily be meeting with potential patients. And police officers are the best example you can give. You know, they go on restricted duties. They're not allowed to engage with the public, et cetera, et cetera. So I cannot see a reason why you should treat this MP any differently to any other public-facing public figure. And the reality is, I suspect there are lots of MPs that want him named because the suspicion currently is pointing at them as well.
Yes.
I think there was some information that was in the public domain that suggested that he was an MP during this period, and he's of certain age, and so there was things on social media which named 9 or 10 of them. as potentially being the person. So I would imagine the other eight or nine might be a bit concerned that they are being
it is interesting. I mean, one of the arguments that have been used, one of the arguments that have been used in the past by naming somebody is, but by failing to name the individual, suspicion falls upon other people mm-hmm. who are absolutely innocent. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the case, but there was one where they end up naming the person because it felt that there were other people who were being accused of it. So there is some real validity to that, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And they can't do their job. Can you, if they are being suspected of whatever it is, just because they are happen to be an MP of a certain age, can you imagine that they're appearing in their constituency offices on a Friday afternoon and people are saying, I don't want to meet with him because it could be him, you know? So they themselves will undoubtedly feel that they, are being treated unfairly as a result of this. So I think, let's be a bit grown up about this. I hope that the media don't go to task. He's innocent or proven guilty. But I think it's important that we have his name in the public domain and that we have some clarity around this. And of course, the other thing, the bigger issue, of course, is that I think there are 56 MPs now facing allegations of sexual misconduct as far as parliamentary standards are concerned. Can you think of any other institution where 1 in 10 or 1 in 11 members of the group are facing such allegations? There is a really sinister issue here, something really that really requires attention as to what's happening in the mother of all parliaments. Why is it that so many parliamentarians are being accused of these behaviours? Is there something amiss in the way that discipline is being carried out? Do they attract? Does being a politician or being parliament, does it attract people who are allegedly misbehaving sexually? I don't know, but I think this is a broader conversation we need to have about who we have leading us.
No, I think absolutely true. And of course, we have very recently heard the case of Neil Parish, who stood down, Tory MP for Tiverton and Honiton, after admitting watching pornography in the House of Commons. Tractor porn, for the want of a better searching title. Searched for tractor porn.
And then we had Imran Khan as well, the MP for Wakefield, who was convicted of sexual abuse going back many, many years. And you had Lord Nazir Ahmed, who was convicted of sexual abuse. That was obviously when he was a youth, way before he became a parliamentarian. But, you've got a spate of these. And again, we're not making any accusations about this particular individual, but power attracts predators. And it is no surprise to either of us, and I suspect to many of our listeners, that I'm afraid there will be people like this who will be behaving in the way that they are.
Well, power and control is a very important element of an offending behaviour, particularly a sex offender. You know, that power and control, which does come with status as an MP, just by its very nature, that can obviously be a massive influence. And you does ask the question, well, is that a very significant element of why individuals are drawn to it? But let's talk a little bit further about it, because I think one of the things that we've talked about a lot is misogyny. Misogyny mm-hmm. that exists within the police service. It still exists now. It's certainly not been eradicated, but it wasn't to the degree that it was or isn't to the degree that it was in the 1970s and 80s. Mm-hmm. Do you think that Parliament is still a long way behind? Do you think that misogyny that existed within the police service is something that's only now starting to come to the forefront and be properly recognised in Parliament?
I don't think Parliament has had its Me Too moment. It may well be having it now, but I don't think it's ever had it. I've come across, I've sat in a room with parliamentarians, and they walk in, some of them, with a stream of young women who are there as interns or on work experience or often lowly paid, if not any pay, jobs. And I always question why that might be the case. Again, I'm not making aspersions, but there are some, it seemed to be a place, unfortunately, where you have a significant number of men and a significant number of young women who are looking for work or are in work. And that is often a recipe for disaster. And so I don't think Parliament's had its Me Too moment. This may be it. But if it isn't, it needs to be. You know, the reality is that it's going to put off. You know, if I was a woman, would I want to work in Parliament, given all of these allegations? It would put me off, you know? So I think we need to recognise the broader impact of not dealing with abuse when and if it occurs.
And, of course, the problem being in Parliament is that it's status, isn't it? So these individuals have such status that many of them put on a pedestal. And as a result of that, they become fairly untouchable. And we've seen that because, you know, you can't sack an MP.
No, you can't. It takes, I mean, they can stay in the role forever as long as they're until the next election. And, I mean, there are rules now about potentially being able to recall them. But, I mean, they're rarely used, if at all. And I think, you know, it's one of these potential jobs for life, particularly if you're in a constituency where, you know, one party's always have the MP.
Yeah.
So you could be in that role for 20, 30, 40 years. And who's going to tell you to step down, and how could they? So it really is a concern. I think Parliament needs to have its Me Too moment. It has to ask people who may have been abused to come forward. It needs to deal with misbehaviour fast. You know, some of these allegations
much quicker than it is doing. These have been around for ages, some of these allegations, not properly concluded, not independently dealt with. I mean, it takes what we need is we need a politician or a number of politicians to say, we are going to get control of this internally, because the only way you can make changes is from within.
Yeah.
So internally, we're going to look at this and we are going to forefront this and we're going to put it out there and we're going to say, right, I'm sorry, let's look, right, go right back and find out where all these allegations are. Let's get a timescale on them, get them resolved properly. Let's get them independently looked at. And we need that.
It needs, I hate to say it, you know, a special squad almost, you know, as we had with Utri and other, you know, other police operations. It needs a particular group of people who are tasked with dealing with this in a timely fashion, fairly, of course, but also ensuring that people are brought to justice where necessary and that people are given an opportunity to talk about their experiences and be listened to and believed. So it can't be dealt with as it's currently being dealt with on a case-by-case basis without any sort of urgency about it, because, you know, it's damaging confidence in our major institutions.
And of course, there is this very interesting piece of legislation which deals with the aspect of being able to come out in court as an MP and say things and not be libeled.
Yeah, absolutely right. If a parliamentary privilege, you know, they can. I mean, they've been told by the Speaker not to name anybody in particular, but, you know, that doesn't stop them. They can say what they like about you and I, and under parliamentary privilege, we'd have to take it on the chin. We can't do anything about it. So, yeah, they have special powers. They obviously can make laws or stand in the way of laws. And that, I think, you know, one of the things that really bugs me is that about a couple of months ago, we were trying to get misogyny to be treated as a hate crime. And the government voted against it, and and then you look at why maybe they may have done so, given the number of allegations that some MPs are facing. So, they are immensely powerful, and they need to be above reproach. And I'm afraid that's not what's happening.
So let's move on to another massive case. Last week I was in court at the Hastings Coroner Court after 5 years of work, finally bringing back to a coroner's court an inquest which resulted in the correct verdict, unlawful killing. Previously, it was a open verdict, the case of Jesse Earle, which I want to talk about in a little while. But before we do that, let's talk about this horrific case. So it became known as the Lady in the Lake Killer. The individual escaped for over 30 years. This goes back to 1987, where a young lady, Shaney Warren, was found in a lake. She had been tied up and gagged. She'd been tied up by the use of a rope and also by jump wires. The pathologist at the time, Dr. Benjamin Davis, concluded that Shaney had committed suicide. yes, committed suicide by tying her own hands and her own feet.
And attempted to strangle herself,
and then gone into the water. A shocking. And this goes to the heart of utter incompetence. And yes, great, DNA has now finally been in a position where we can say now who killed her. Donald Robertson, who himself is a very nasty piece of work. But it took 30 years. And this pathologist to come out and say that, you know, the police should have been right from the very beginning saying, no, I'm sorry, this is utterly wrong. And totally blacklisted this pathologist.
Absolutely. Well, I understand he was taken off the list sometime before and then reinstated just before Shani Warren's pathology report. So, yes, they obviously had concerns about him then. Some basic things weren't done. You know, the gag that she had wasn't examined until recently. Had they done that, well, you know, they would have found clearly that she hadn't committed suicide. And of course, there was no evidence that she ever wanted to commit suicide, which I think is quite a relevant factor, or ought to have been a relevant factor back in 37 years ago. But the saddest thing, well, one of so many things are sad about this case, Mark, but, you know, the fact that this man went on to abuse others over the years. So had he been brought to justice 37 years ago, obviously Shani's parents are no longer here to see that, which is terrible in itself, but other women suffered at his hands because nothing was done about his murdering Shani Warren. And that, I think, causes us, you know, real thoughts about why we, you know, what the consequences are when people get things wrong.
Yeah, I mean, let's, for example, 2 months after Shani Warren's murder, and only a matter of a few miles away from the scene, a 17-year-old girl is walking home and she's stranger attacked and raped. And he wasn't brought to justice for that until 2010. And there is also the attack of a 14-year-old girl in 1981, where he attacks her in relation to a rape. Now, his previous offences were all rapes, but rapes of women, stranger attacks. And you have to look at it and go, why is it that this individual didn't feature previously? Because he didn't. He did not feature in any capacity at all. No. And this is looking at the heart of police investigations to say there but needs to be a better database. There needs to be more clarity in terms of unsolved murders and linking those stranger attacks. Because what we do know is stranger attacks of young women does have a consistency in terms of stranger attacks of rapes, where those rapes perhaps are detected.
And they're rare. So
they are rare.
They can, you know, almost know who might be responsible because they've caught them before. Or, you know, in this particular case, you know, he was caught before. He was, you know, attempted rape of a 15-year-old girl in 1977. He got 5 years for that. He was released in 1981. So he's clearly on their books. They know what he's capable of. He was in the area. He lives in the area. I mean, I don't know. I mean, somebody might accuse me of being Captain Hindsight here, but, you know, it's not. It's not that. We know from our own experience that somebody just needs to do a 2+2 and it'll come up with the 4. But nobody bothered to do that. Everybody works in little silos and doesn't really address the issue. And he gets away with it. He plays on the fact that the system will fail and has failed. So he can carry on, as you say, 3 months after Shani Warren's murder, raping another woman and then raping another and carrying on as if there is no consequence to his terrible behavior.
Yeah, I mean, Shani Warren was murdered in 1987. Robertson's convictions for raping two girls, a 14 and a 17-year-old, in two separate incidents in 1981 and then 1987. His convictions for burglary with intent to commit rape and the kidnap of a woman in April 1990. If that didn't flag him as a potential suspect in relation to other crimes around that time, 1981, 1987, 1990. You know, this is a period of time where you've got an individual not far away from where Shani Warren was murdered, Taptow Lake. Why was there nobody saying, hang on a minute, we've got a predator here who is abducting women, who's raping women, who's breaking into houses. Could this individual not be the person responsible for Shani? And I do, the investigating officer who did a review, I have to pull him up because he said, you know, I don't think on review that there were many mistakes made at the time by the investigating team. I'm sorry, there were lots of mistakes made, none more so than accepting the pathologist. You know, the police should have come out and utterly criticised that pathologist and said, I'm sorry, no, this pathologist is completely wrong. Gone and got a proper pathology from somebody else who showed that actually this is not suicide.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, her watch, her lighter had been abandoned, her car was in a nearby, her car key was missing. You know, there's so many things that would tell you, hang on a minute, this is not what you think it is. And, you know, I, as I say, and I agree with you entirely, the failures were obvious. The failures were sad and depressing because we've seen it far too often. And it's just not on to say, well, hang on a minute, it was a one-off or it wasn't as bad as you make out. You know, Shani Warren's killer went on to not only evade justice for her murder, but carry on raping for decades to come. And there's an issue about the parole board as well, Mark. You know, the parole board released him on a couple of occasions, not recognizing the risk that he continued to pose. We've discussed before how that needs revamping, because I think the risk assessments they carry out are not really fit for purpose. And so you've got individuals who are being released who really remain a threat without having been rehabilitated or treated in any way, shape or form, and they come out and they carry on doing what they've always done. And I think we've got to have this root and branch reform, really, in how we deal with sex offenders and how we deal and risk assess. And at the broader point you make about failure, we've got to acknowledge when we get things wrong, because the public don't buy it when you say it was a one-off or maybe it wasn't as bad as you think it was.
And let's pick up that parole board very shortly. But let me just give you, as you know, I've been covering the case of Jessie Earle, whose body was found in 1989 in Beachy Head. She vanished in 1980. We have, after a five-year struggle now, been very successful in getting a new inquest, and the outcome of that inquest has now been determined unlawful killing. The case was recorded as a murder in 2001, eventually by Sussex Police, although in 1989, when the skeletal remains were found of Jessie, the police were very clear to say this will not be recorded as a murder. What's come out in court is the utter failings of the police investigation, the incompetency of that and those initial police investigations. And what has really frustrated both the family and us as the legal team is this position that the police adopted. This is Sussex Police. So Sussex Police have said to the family over the past 5 years, when we've put them on notice that we are looking to bring this back to court, is that they fully support the family. They are very sorry that there hasn't been a resolve in respect of this, but they fully support the family. When we've asked them then, therefore, to support us in relation to bringing this application back and having the right outcome of an inquest, they have taken an impartial stance. They've said that we neither support or don't support. And what's come out in court is that they have, after being repeatedly asked to disclose documents, files, they've refused to do that, and in many cases argued public interest. What's shocking with all of this is when the police get it wrong, and they got it wrong massively with Jessie Earle, and the watch changes. So I'm not talking about the same chief constable. I'm not talking about the same senior investigating officer. It's all changed. What really, really annoys me, and it's not me, it's the families that it's the biggest impact on, why they can't simply come out and say, we got it wrong, we hold our hands up, we can't change what's happened, but what we can do is fully support you and move forward. Why don't these senior officers do that? And I'm particularly the Chief Constable of Sussex Police, who has been appalling in this.
Well, I wonder whether or not there's something to do with compensation having to be paid. When you admit you're wrong, you're left open to potentially liable, you know, being liable for that. Whether they think that's more important than actually, as you've just said a moment ago, coming clean and accepting that what happened 30, 40 years ago was wrong. I don't know what it is. We just have a real averseness to admitting when we've failed or when people have failed. You know, this is another example, as you know better than anybody else, you know, where suicide was the verdict given by an officer, which then everybody seemed to accept. By everybody, I mean the police, accepted, which then meant using tunnel vision, they didn't look for anything else. You know, the reality is this is far too common. And I think, you know, leaders lead, and leaders should accept responsibility rather than put the family through the mill in the way that they've done in Jesse's case, in Shaney's case, and in countless others. You know, I think we really need to get the leaders we deserve, and maybe we don't have them.
So let's move on to the tragic case of baby Peter, known as Baby P, who died after months of horrific abuse. Tracy Connolly was jailed indefinitely with a minimum period of 5 years in May 2009. Dominic Raab, the Justice Secretary, has said this week, and actually he tweeted about it, which says, Tracy Connolly's cruelty towards her son, Baby Peter, was pure evil. The decision to release her demonstrates why the parole board needs a fundamental overhaul, including a ministerial check for the most serious offenders, so that it serves and protects the public. What do you think? I mean, the parole board, we talked about that literally just now. It's a bit of a mess, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it has been. I think it might be in the process of being improved, but certainly there is, and this is a good another example of it, where yeah, the public don't really believe what it says and don't accept what it, there's a lack of transparency, Mark. We don't know what they considered. They will say, for confidentiality reasons, we can't tell you what we've considered. Well, you know, the public don't buy that. And I mean, the last thing I want, by the way, is for Dominic Raab, a minister, to get involved in sentencing. We've been there before. That's why we took that away from them and gave it to judges. What we need is much more transparency about the process. People need to know what factors were considered. You know, I don't believe in the death penalty. I don't believe that people should be people in prison for the whole of their lives. But I don't want that. There's only 51 of those. Most people will at some point be released on a license. And we need to ensure that the risks are managed, as we've said earlier. We need to ensure that the public understand why that might happen, why it might be necessary to release somebody. We need to do it openly. We had a proper conversation about this. The parole board, it was in a bad way, and John Warboys is another example.
Yeah,
where,
I mean, that was challenged, wasn't it?
It was challenged.
Successfully challenged in court.
Correctly. You know, where they simply accept some psychologist saying, oh, he's all right, you know, nothing to worry about here. And I think people need to understand that the public do not get that and will not understand that unless you share with them much more information. And I think it's a bit, I don't know, but you know, for the minister to say, well, you know, I would have done something differently, and if you'd given it to me, well, the minister sent his representatives along to the parole board initially, and they agreed with the outcome of the parole board in releasing Tracy Connolly. So you can't have it both ways and say, well, I want to be involved and stop it happening, when you actually sent people along and didn't stop it happening. So I don't get it. Let's have a much more transparent system. Let's hear much more of the evidence. Yeah, maybe even have some of these hearings heard in public and streamed and live. I think live stream, so you can see what conversations are being had, why it is that somebody is now being released. Because I think they owe it to us.
But isn't that the root of it? Because if you statistically look at the release of individuals from prison, so the numbers for 2020 and 2021, the parole board released 4,289 offenders and directed that 12,154 remain in prison. So that's 74% of those who come before the parole board are not given parole.
Yep.
And of those released, 27 committed further serious offences. So that's a statistic rate of 0.5. So if you look at it from statistics, it tells you that the offending rate is incredibly small. But the problem is, unless you support that evidentially and you make that transparent, and I guess that's the root of this, is that unless you have a parole board who can be seen to be making the right decisions because they're providing that information for the public, it's very difficult for them to be believed.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, as you say, very small numbers of people reoffend, but they tend to reoffend with very serious crimes. I think that's one of the problems.
I mean, let's be clear, one of those 27 is one too many.
Yeah, exactly that. And I think that we, as I said, we need more transparency. Perhaps more use of polygraph testing, not reliant upon one expert saying this individual is no longer a risk. We need the public more engaged in this. I wonder whether or not, a jury of some kind should decide. You know,
yes.
12 randomly selected members of the public should be part of the parole board process. These are, questions. I don't have any view on it. I just think we need a broader conversation because, as you say, one person released who then reoffends and commits a very serious crime is one too many. And yes, the parole board gets it right most of the time, but when it doesn't get it right, there are massive consequences.
And this is the root of most of these issues, is if people were more transparent, if people were more open, particularly those of either government or authorities, then you could be more understanding in relation to why decisions are made.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know why. I don't know why people don't get that. Well, by people, I mean politicians and authorities. Why don't they get that actually you will get more confidence? People will understand. The number of times I've sat in a room, and you will have as well, with a victim, for example, and you've said to them, I'm afraid the evidence, I know what happened to you, but the evidence would not support a prosecution, and here is the evidence, and here's the issues that we face. And they go away saying, well, thank you, I understand that. Mm. And that's the end of the matter. But what we tend to do is we send them an email with a Word document saying we've decided that we shouldn't prosecute, or whatever it is. We don't have these proper conversations which are open and transparent, where we explain everything in great detail, because I don't know why. I have no idea. Maybe people just lack confidence. Hmm. Maybe people aren't trained or don't feel able to have those proper conversations where they, as we said earlier on, admit when they got things wrong and when there may be issues, et cetera, et cetera. But it leaves us in a bad place where people just don't believe a word anybody says anymore.
And I think you're right. I think sometimes those people making the decisions lack the confidence in the decision they're making, so therefore they just hide behind a process.
Yeah.
Whereas what we need is greater confidence in those making those decisions around risk that can be, risk can be managed in many circumstances.
Absolutely.
But you've got to be able to be clear in terms of how one is managing that, and to make sure that you've taken everything into consideration when you're making that decision.
Yeah. No, yeah, you're absolutely right. We've gone to a stage now where I left the CPS 6 years ago now, I was regularly outside of my office explaining a decision, regularly on the media or radio. Now you hardly ever see it, Mark. And I just wonder whether or not people just become scared or whatever it is, whatever the problem is.
Well, I think people are scared of making a decision and making a decision that they then have to qualify. But I think that's the process. They just hide behind it.
It's what you get paid for.
That's my call. Well, yeah, but explain why.
Yeah, the reason. Yeah, exactly. Leadership. This comes back again to the issue of leadership. Leadership. You lead by example. You explain by example. You give people all the information they need to hear. You give them stuff, warts and all. You accept responsibility. You accept where you got something right. That is what we need to be doing more of. And people just seem to want to hide away in a room and send out a press release, and it just ain't good enough.
And I think, you and I are of that mentality, but as we've gone through life, unfortunately, we've met an awful lot of people who just don't come up to that level, do they?
No, they don't. And I despair because, we deserve the leaders that we deserve, and we don't get the leaders that we deserve. We get people who are scared, who lack confidence, who prefer to hide stuff. And all that does is make people think, well, I don't believe a word that anybody says anymore.
No, and that's right. And that's where it goes to the heart. Right at the very beginning with regards to the MPs. We've got to have trust in these people, haven't we? And if we don't have trust in them, how are we in a position that we can give confidence?
Not at all. Trust is we've lost honesty. We've lost integrity. We've lost truth. We've lost transparency, and we've most of all we've lost trust. And nothing now that, you know, you just go on social media, people will be saying, I don't believe a word he says, don't believe a word she says. And as a consequence, fake news wins out. And people just think, well, what's the point anymore? And, you know, we just need to be much more open now and not be scared about getting things wrong, because we're human and we do get things wrong. But don't hide it. Don't cover it up. Explain it.
So I want to talk about this case, which I found horrific. And, you know, I've got daughters and you've got...
I've got one daughter.
Yeah. One daughter and a son. And I think one of the things that really I struggle with for youth generation is this whole profile around social media and where it can end up being abused. And we've got this week a individual, Graham Mansey, 52 years old, who's a driving instructor, who created a TikTok account and did lots of other things in order to basically stalk and harass this 17-year-old student to such a degree that he paid people to try and hack her social media. He stalked her. He created a fake WhatsApp group. He pretended to be a student. He was challenged by the girl's parents and he said, I love your daughter. This individual goes to court. He admits the offences of stalking in court, but he breaches his conditions. He's given 8 weeks imprisonment, suspended for 12 months. This girl's life has been massively impacted. She finds it very difficult now to go out. Her whole eating and mental health has been massively affected by this individual. This social media, this whole process where you can gain access to people, where you can create a fake profile, it's really affecting young children because they don't have the ability to perhaps understand it to the degree that you and I have because of the amount of work and people we've seen over the years.
But as we said before, and you've been a victim, I've been a victim, it's not just children that are encountering this kind of behavior. But undoubtedly, there isn't enough support available for people like her. I mean, she talks about how she stopped wearing her coat, she cut her hair because he complimented her on both of those. And she didn't want anything to be related to him. She can't sleep. She feels vulnerable. You know, there used to be a time when you were stalked, or felt guilty, or felt that you were scared in some way. You could just close the door. You can't close the door anymore because they're online, and you've got phones, and you've got tablets, and you've got computers, and you've got your TV, your smart TV. You can be caught and trapped and chased everywhere and anywhere, and there is nothing available. I mean, yeah, we've got some conversations being had about whether people should be able to be anonymous. Well, I don't believe they should. You know, there are so many people that troll me and troll you, I'm sure, Mark, where they just have a flag or something in their picture and they call themselves some really number with lots of numbers attached to it. And, you know, it's not fair. It's not right that people should be able to hide behind that in order to attack you because they couldn't do that in the street. If they're in the street, you know, you'd know who they were. And as you say, young people, particularly vulnerable people, not just young people, but vulnerable people generally, will take these attacks in a more hostile way than anybody else. And they will suffer and they will pay. They'll probably suffer in silence. And we've talked earlier on about suicide. We talk here about the growth of people who harm themselves, who lock themselves away, who change, whose mental health is impacted. All these things happen. Because they were being targeted in this way. And whilst we can't stop the growth of social media, it is the future. There's no getting away from it. It's the now and the future. We've got to be able to, one, educate young people to deal with whatever's thrown at them, make them more resilient. But also the platforms need to do more about policing this so that they ensure that these abusers don't get the opportunity to do so.
Absolutely. I want to talk about one other thing just before we draw to a close, and that's obviously the ongoing Madeleine McCann investigation. My program went out very recently and continues to go out in some countries in relation to my investigation into Christian B. I very clearly put out there the evidence that has been presented by the German prosecutor. I'm very clear to say I don't have all of it, but the main significant ones, which is, can he place Christian B outside the apartment of Madeleine on the night of her disappearance, and can he place him using that telephone? And whilst he was absolutely certain at the interview he could, when challenged on that in the later part of the interview, he said he couldn't. One of the things that I've been very clear to say is that as a prosecutor, you've got to be really careful in terms of your terminology and the words that you use, because ultimately, and I've challenged him on this now, I've very clearly come out and said, well, you've been investigating Christian B for the last 3 years. You've absolutely asserted worldwide that Christian B is responsible for killing Madeleine and disposing of her body in Portugal, although you don't know how or where. And what I've said to him is, you know, it's time now to either shut up or bring those charges. He'll put up. Yeah, because as a prosecutor, you've just got to be really careful. It's not your decision to say this man is responsible. What is your decision to say is there is sufficient evidence for it to be brought to a trial for the courts to decide.
Yeah. No, absolutely right. I mean, and you can over-egg a case. Again, it leads people thinking, you know, people have already made assumptions about this particular individual based on the language of the prosecutor and the investigators. So you've got to be immensely capable. We've said before, we talk about allegations. We talk about the fact that there may or may not be enough evidence. We use that kind of terminology. We never say until somebody's been convicted that they're guilty. And we never give that impression. The moment you give that impression, that person firstly can't get a fair trial, which potentially means the whole case is going to be dropped anyway. Secondly, it raises people's expectations, and if those expectations can't be met, Mark, people then think the whole system is at fault. So, you know, you're right. Language is very, very important, and from what you've said, you're quite right to be concerned about the language that's being used.
Brilliant. Well, listen, another fantastic week. We could talk for hours and hours, but we won't bore our listeners with that. So, thank you so much again, Nazir. Please do keep talking to your friends. Subscribe to our podcast, drop us an email. Just tell us whether you like it, whether you think there's areas we can improve on, and also keep updating us in relation to cases or matters that you'd like us to discuss. We do respond to every single one of them. Have a good week. Look after yourselves, and we will see you again next week. Take care, Nazir.
Bye now.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kayes, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.